David, you are a rare treasure. An academic linguist with a deep interest in and a long history of involvement in the theatre. How did these two strands get entwined in your career?
Well, I can't remember a time when I wasn't fascinated by theatre. My mum used to produce plays for a repertory company in Holyhead, and I'd be brought along to the rehearsals. That was before I even went to school. Then, as a teenager, she took me to Stratford and I saw my first Shakespeare play. I still have vivid memories of Paul Robeson's Othello in flowing white robes and Sam Wanamaker darting about as Iago. Well, I've kept up the theatre connection since. I did some acting and playwriting at university. I have had dozens of roles in various reps, from panto villains to Shylock, and I've toured a couple of solo shows. I've done a little bit of directing too, a production of Under Milk Wood a few years ago, and written a play about endangered languages. So there's definitely a theatre gene somewhere, which has been passed on, as a matter of fact, for son Ben is an actor, who's also done some directing and producing, and keeping up with what he's doing has added a fresh dimension to the theatrical side of my life. My fascination with language has run in parallel to all this. I can trace it back to growing up in a bilingual community in Wales and then being exposed to several languages in school. It came to the boil when I went to university, where there were courses on the history of English, comparative philology, phonetics, and all sorts of other goodies. I was reading English, and the beauty of that course, it was at University College London, was the nicely balanced language and literature syllabus. So it was Shakespeare in the morning, linguistics in the afternoon sort of thing, for 3 years. I had great teachers on both sides, Hilda Hume on Shakespeare, Randolph Quirk on language, and learned from them my basic principle that language and literature are two sides of a single coin. They inform each other so marvellously. And when I started teaching linguistics myself, much of my early work was on stylistics, and that's been a major theme in my writing ever since. Shakespeare has always been the great unifying factor for me. So I suppose it was only a matter of time before I started researching and writing about his language myself. But this didn't happen until the 1990s. Three things happened then to bring him into centre stage, as it were. A new repertory company was formed in Holyhead, and I found myself acting in several of his plays, along with Hilary and Ben. And then Ben decided to go into the theatre professionally, and eventually we collaborated on various projects, such as Shakespeare's Words and the Shakespeare Miscellany. And then thirdly, the editor of the magazine at Shakespeare's Globe asked me to write regular pieces on Shakespeare's use of language for Around the Globe. And I found myself being sucked into the professional Shakespeare world, adding a linguistic perspective to various projects, such as the Wells and Taylor edition of the collected works. Once Shakespeare gets hold of you, he doesn't let you go, it seems. The links with the Globe grew. I went to see most of their productions and gave various talks for their education department. I was their Sam Wanamaker Fellow in 2003. And so when the Globe called with a new idea in 2004, I was well primed.
The story of that new idea is thrillingly told in Pronouncing Shakespeare, of course, which I picked up at the little bookstore across from the Shakespeare Birthplace in Stratford in 2005. I couldn't put it down. Devoured it in a single sitting. I won't ask you to tell that whole story again here, but I would love to hear you talk about the different relationship that Elizabethans had with language from the relationship we have with it today. Spelling, closer to pronunciation, no standard prestige dialect yet. Or was there? They certainly seemed in the throes of actually creating language, something we are scared to do. Were the poets deliberately trying to elevate English to stand alongside the classical languages of Greek and Latin?
Well, not just the poets, to take your last question first. Scholars, too, were anxious to show that English had come of age. There's a splendid statement from William Camden in 1605. He was Ben Jonson's tutor. Our English tongue, he says, is, I will not say, as sacred as the Hebrew or as learned as the Greek, but as fluent as the Latin, as courteous as the Spanish, as court-like as the French, and as sonorous as the Italian. Well, nobody would have been able to write this a century before, But during the 16th century, a huge amount of linguistic development took place, with tens of thousands of new words of classical origin entering the language, offering fresh opportunities for stylistic expression. The rapid pace of development worried some, of course. Poets wondered if their words would be understood by later generations. "We write in sand," said one, sadly. And it was this sense of unchecked progress, chaos even, which led to later writers wanting to fix the language. Swift with his notion of an academy, Johnson with his dictionary, and so on. Actually creating language? Well, certainly. I've said in several places that the main linguistic lesson we can learn from Shakespeare, and others of the time, is how to be daring with language. There was an instinct to be creative, and no institutional mindset to counter it, no dictionaries yet. The first, Caudry's Alphabetical Table of Hard Words, didn't get published until 1604. And there were no influential grammars, and only the first primitive attempts at fixing spelling, such as Richard Mulcaster's spelling lists. Now, Mulcaster is one of the pedants who may have been the model for Holofernes in Love's Labour's Lost, and it's interesting to see, in the way Holofernes treats spelling, the beginnings of a prestige usage. You're right, there was no standard pronunciation yet. Received pronunciation didn't develop in Britain until the end of the 18th century, but there was an emerging sense of the special status of the written language. You should pronounce debt as D-E-B-T, says Holofernes, and he's horrified to hear Don Armado leave out the B. Well, this privileging of writing over speech we still have today, for instance, pronouncing the T in often, often, because it's there in the spelling. It was the only way educated people in Elizabethan England could show in their pronunciation that they were educated. There was no expectation that an upper-class person on stage would have a posh, non-regional accent, for there was no such accent at that time. Regional accents weren't a barrier to social advancement, as they would be later. Raleigh and Drake had strong Devonshire accents, and after 1603, the sound of the court was strongly Scottish. Spelling was indeed closer to pronunciation, and this is an important source of evidence for OP. When Mercutio talks about Queen Mab's whip as having a lash of film, and both folio and quarto spell film as P-H-I-L-O-M-E, we can deduce a two-syllable pronunciation. It's natural enough, as we know from modern Irish English, where we hear exactly that. Film. Are you going to the film? Or to take another example, in Sonnet 67 we find live at the end of line 1 and achieve at the end of line 3. Is there evidence to justify that rhyme? Well, yes, because there are spellings elsewhere in Shakespeare of achieve as A-T-C-H-I-V-E. Achieve. Now, this sort of thing is gold dust when we start focusing on the detail of OP.
Perhaps we should spend a little time on the evidence question. Always the biggest question, right? You told me you had some new thoughts about the evidence for OP that you didn't write about in Pronouncing Shakespeare. Are you going to break new ground here?
It's certainly the question that leaps into the mind of an audience whenever they hear OP. How do you know? It's not so much that I've had new thoughts about the process, just a wider range of examples. As I say in the book, there are three kinds of evidence. The spelling evidence that we've just mentioned. The second kind is what we can deduce from the puns and rhymes which don't work in modern English. Each new transcription of a play or poem into OP brings to light fresh examples, and I expect the process to continue for quite some time, as so far only two plays have been done in their entirety, Romeo and Troilus. Well, three, of course, when Your Dream is produced, and the sonnets. But the most important kind of evidence comes from the comments of contemporaries, especially the orthoepists, writing about the spelling system and telling us, often in considerable phonetic detail, how words were pronounced, where the main stress was, whether they rhymed, and so on. I've read more of these sources than when I worked on Romeo, and the evidence for particular OP decisions has built up as a result. For example, the sonnets rhyme love with such words as prove and move, several times. Which way should the rhyme go? Should we lengthen the vowel of love to make it like move, or shorten the vowel of move to make it like love? Ben Jonson, in his English grammar, gives us the answer. This is what he says about letter O. It naturally soundeth, in the short time, more flat, and akin to O, as cousin, dozen, mother, brother, love, prov. And in another section, he brings together love, glove, and move. Now, this doesn't exclude the possibilities that in other accents there might have been a long vowel version of love, of course, a sort of love or louve, but it does provide clear support for the choice I made in my transcription.
When I told you I wanted to direct an O.P. Shakespeare, I asked you if there was one that deserved this treatment or begged for it. Your immediate answer was A Midsummer Night's Dream, and that's the one you and I are working on together. Why Dream?
Chiefly because it's got lots of rhyming couplets, many of which don't work in modern English. One of the big things about OP is that it makes the rhymes work. Here's a couple of examples from Dream. One and alone don't rhyme today in this couplet from Puck, but they do in OP. Then will two a dance woo own, that must needs be sport alone. And here's an example from Oberon, where in modern English there's a phonesthetic clash between the E endings of archery, gloriously, and remedy, and the I endings of die, I, sky, and by. In OP, the repeated I endings produce a dreamy, hypnotic effect, highly appropriate to what Oberon's doing at this point, to my mind. Floor of this purple day, hit with Cupid's archery, sinking apple of his eye, let her shine as gloriously as the Venus of the sky. When thou wakest, if she be by, beg of her for remedy. But making the rhymes work isn't the only reason. I'm also expecting OP to reveal some interesting puns. I can't say what these are right now, they'll become apparent only as the transcription proceeds. But to take an example from Romeo, I had no idea, nor it would seem from editor's notes had anyone else, that there was a possible wordplay in the prologue. From forth the fatal lines of these two foes. In OP, loins and lines would sound the same. Lines. There are bound to be examples like this in Dream. And finally, there's the novel auditory experience that arises simply from hearing this kind of pronunciation for the first time, an accent that hasn't been heard on stage for 400 years. People generally find it exhilarating, especially when, as routinely happened in the Globe productions, the OP made the actors reinterpret their relationship with their characters. I recall the actor playing Mercutio saying that he found his Queen Mab speech much more meaningful in the earthy tones of OP than in the posh tones of RP. So I'm expecting to hear some interesting effects when the dream fairies and mechanicals start to use it. The tongue-tripping rate of OP also affects the actor's movement, and that too is likely to be important in this play.
I'm glad you brought up earthy and posh. Modern Shakespeare productions, certainly British ones, have a ready-made device in today's accents for revealing the social status of the characters. As a dialect coach, I gravitate towards the use of accents and dialects as a way to sharpen the narrative and reveal character differences. I worry, rather, that with everyone speaking OP in Dream, I won't have the same scope. The mechanicals obviously beg for OP. But what about the fairy kingdom and the courtly characters? Will you be recommending dramatically different shades of OP for our production?
Oh, indeed, yes. Though the decision as to what counts as dramatic is yours as director, not mine. Well, it's first to appreciate the difference between phonetics, the study of human-produced sound, and phonology, the study of the sound system of a language. OP is my attempt to establish the phonological system of early modern English, and it allows the same kind of phonetic variations as happen in modern English. No two people have exactly the same accent, because of their voice quality differences. and people from different parts of the English-speaking world have more or less the same phonological system despite their many regional differences. One has to say more or less because some accents are more different than others. It would have been the same in early modern English. London would have contained dozens of accents with its multicultural population and a huge inward movement of people from the Midlands and East Anglia. We know which parts of the country many of the actors on the Globe stage came from, and they would have ended up with an accent that was a mix of their home region and London. So there'd never have been phonetic uniformity on the Globe stage, and we'd have heard many shades of OP. It's perfectly possible to rhyme own and alone, for example, in a Norfolk way, or a Cockney way, or a Scots way, and so on. Or again, everyone in the 1580s would have pronounced musician as musician, and this would have been pronounced in various regional ways. Also, OP has nothing to say about regional variations in intonation and tone of voice, which can be as varied as people want, so it's a mistake to think of OP as if it were a single accent. Now, when we did Romeo and Troilus, we maintained this principle. The actors were told not to lose their natural accents, but to speak the OP speech as trippingly as they could in their natural voices. So we had a Juliet who sounded Scottish, a nurse from the East End of London, and a Peter from Northern Ireland, as well as some RP speakers. But they all modified their accents to rhyme own with alone, and so on. Some of these accents were closer to OP than others, of course. Those who already had a post-vocalic R in their accents found OP easier to acquire than those who didn't. And there were different phonetic qualities of post-vocalic R, from a fricative R to a trill. At least some speakers in Jacobean England trilled their R, for Ben Jonson tells us that the sound hrth, that is, vibrates. It's important to appreciate that none of these accents had a ready-made association with poshness. That kind of association came in much later, in the late 1700s, with the emergence of received pronunciation. There were, of course, accents associated with the court. Notably, the Scots accents would have been everywhere after 1603. But there was no upper-class accent. Drake and Raleigh, as I've already mentioned, are famous examples of people who kept their strong Devonshire accents. If one wanted to show one was really educated, then one might pronounce words as they were spelled, as satirised in Holofernes, but this was a new trend, which is presumably why Shakespeare homed in on it in this way. My Romeo actors were at first a bit nonplussed by this information. How are we to show poshness, for example in The Prince, if there's no RP, they asked. The director, Tim Carroll, had an answer for them. Act, he said. And indeed, through their posture, clothing, facial expressions, movement and so on, they had no trouble. Having said that, there are some variations which can help to suggest character differences, and any director has some choices to make. The fact of the matter is that OP was changing throughout the period Shakespeare was writing. Musician in 1580 was becoming musician. Gone was sometimes pronounced to rhyme with John and sometimes with Joan. Gone, gone. It's no different today, of course. Many words have alternative pronunciations, but a director can make use of these variations in interesting ways. So, for example, in Romeo, we gave the more conservative pronunciations, like musician, to the older characters and the trendier ones to the young bloods. It was the director who decided who said what. Who would Juliet identify with, for instance? Tim Carroll generally felt that, as the audience was coming to the play to hear OP, they should get their money's worth, as it were. So whenever there was a choice, he'd go for the older variants. Another example of this choice was the use of initial H, which could be present or dropped, again, without any suggestion of lack of education or carelessness. Since the 18th century, H-dropping has had a bad image, so it's possible for an OP director to capitalise on this by having some characters keep their H's and some not. It wouldn't be doing harm to OP to have the courtly characters in Dream keep their H's, and the mechanicals not. It would, of course, be reading in some modern values into OP, but I doubt if it's possible to avoid that completely anyway, given that our audience experience can never be an authentic duplication of the Elizabethan setting.
That distinction between the phonological and the phonetic is tremendously helpful, David. In the notes to accompany your transcription of Troilus and Cressida for Shakespeare's Globe in 2005, you wrote, "The pronunciation represented is my interpretation of an underlying system for early modern English. Its aim is to show the major differences between then and now. It is not an attempt to show the phonetic detail of each sound. Any one of the sounds shown could have been articulated in a variety of subtly different ways, just as today the sound in, say, two can be said with slightly more or slightly less lip rounding, slightly higher or slightly lower in the mouth, and so on. Doubtless at the time, the actors, who came from different parts of the country, brought their individual accents to their parts. The same can happen with this production. There should be no effort made to make everyone sound exactly the same." But in the absence of a standard prestige pronunciation system, and given that there were differences between regional pronunciations as noticeable as today's, what led you to advocate moth, price, strut, and trap with those specific phonetic values when offering your interpretation of OP? I can't help wondering if the Lancashire and Sussex sounds of 1600 were as different from each other as they are today. After all, today's strut and strut are not just shades of the same vowel, but live in rather different regions of the vowel space.
There certainly were regional differences comparable to those we hear today. We know this because occasionally orthoepists remark on it, or sometimes make an unusual recommendation that could reflect the part of the country they come from. For example, the writer John Hart came from Devon, and he permits long vowels in such words as above, above, probably, or something like that. And the dramatists sometimes help. For instance, Shakespeare's use of z in the representation of rural speech in King Lear. But these observations are rare. We know next to nothing, really, about early modern English regional accent variation. I've done nothing original in choosing phonetic values for the various vowels. A huge amount of research into the phonology of the period by such scholars as Dobson and Kerkeritz has led to conclusions about which areas of the vowel space are involved in the articulation of each phoneme, and I stood on their shoulders and made my own decisions when they disagree. This isn't the place to explain how historical phonology works, but it should be obvious that deductions about the values of the Elizabethan period have to mesh with deductions about Old, Middle, and Modern English. We have a system in continuous development from the days when the English alphabet was first devised down to the present day. We know the end point, which is how we speak now, and we assume system in the beginning point. If a vowel sound is represented by one letter, we assume it was a pure vowel. If with two identical letters, a long vowel. And if with two different letters, a diphthong, with the letters representing sounds similar to the vowels as shown in isolation. And so on. The evidence of rhymes and orthoepist descriptions helps to sharpen the analysis for the early modern period. The results are that for some vowels, we can be quite precise about the area of vowel space involved. Oo, for instance, the long oo vowel. For others, such as the strut vowel, there's less certainty. You have to make a judgment. And this is where other linguists might, almost certainly would, reach different conclusions from mine. The best one can say is that my version is plausible, one of several possible plausible versions. One also reflects one's upbringing in such matters. No one is an intellectual island. I learnt my historical phonology from A.C. Gimson. See, for instance, the representation of early modern English in his Introduction to the Pronunciation of English, and I remain influenced by that. And when I was preparing for my encounter with Romeo, I went to see John Barton at his London flat to compare our two versions, for John had supervised an OP production of Julius Caesar in Cambridge many years before and had retained his interest in it. He did some, I did some. The two versions were almost identical. But then I reflected, who had taught him his OP? It was Daniel Jones. And Daniel Jones was Gimson's teacher, too. So there was an inevitable family resemblance. What this means in production, of course, is that there are no grounds for being phonetically pedantic about actors' versions of these sounds. When I worked at the Globe, if someone tried to do a strut vowel and didn't get it exactly like mine, say by fronting it a bit more, strut, or rounding it slightly, strut, I wouldn't bother to correct them. On the other hand, if they went too far away from it so that there was a danger of confusion with another sound or of missing a rhyme or a pun, then I would. Actors are actors, not phoneticians, but they do have to be reasonably competent phonologists.
This is sharpening my vision of our production immensely, also my enthusiasm for it. Incidentally, as an actor who got deeply into phonetics, my heritage is also through Gimson, who came to Rose Bruford's, where I trained, to administer the IPA proficiency test. We'd practiced for it listening to the old 78 RPM Daniel Jones Cardinal Vowel LPs. I haven't gone into historical phonology, though, other than briefly in Gimson's book and Accents of English by J.C. Wells, who took over the phonetics chair at University College, right? I must come to grips with Kukeritz. But switching topic a little, other than your productions at the Globe and John Barton's at Cambridge, have there been other professional OP productions you know about? Other academic theatre productions? You must be approached all the time by people like me whom you've inspired. And how would you sum up audience reactions to OP productions? They're scared enough that they won't understand, so why on earth am I trying to intimidate them further, I ask myself. Even my own department had misgivings when I proposed the production.
Well, to take your last point first, I'm not surprised. There's a huge ignorance about OP out there, which the Globe had too. That was the main reason they hadn't done this before. They'd done original everything else, movement, costumes, music, but not pronunciation. And that's because they thought like this. They're open only half of the year. We don't get a government subsidy of any kind. So to survive, we have to fill the place for every performance. If we put on an OP production, people won't understand it. The news will get around and audiences will drop. We can't take the risk. Well, Tim Carroll managed to persuade them that they should have a go by using a clever stratagem. He said, if you don't do it first, Stratford will. So the Globe management agreed, but cautiously, because the Romeo production was only to be for a weekend in the middle of a season in modern English. Of course, it only takes a few moments to realise that the belief that people won't understand it is absolute nonsense. All you have to do is listen to it. But of course, at the time, there were no easily available recordings to get rid of the panic. There are now. There are downloadable files from my own site, www.pronouncingshakespeare.com. The Globe has produced a CD of words and music called This World's Globe, which has some dialogue in OP. And I'm sure more audio material will become available as more productions take place. Unfortunately, the Globe has never gone in for marketing its productions in the way that the RSC has. Every production at the Globe is filmed, and both of my OP productions are there in the archive, accessible upon request, but they're not on sale at all, which is a shame. So I hope your production, Paul, will be made available in some way. The fact of the matter is that OP is no more different from the accents we hear on the BBC or NPR than most other regional accents in the UK, USA, or anywhere else. In fact, some regional accents in modern English are much more difficult. I went around the audiences in both the Romeo and Troilus productions and asked people how they were finding it. Most said they were quite used to the accent by the end of Act 1, Scene 1. None said they had difficulty with it. All claimed to recognise it, in the sense that they heard echoes of their own regional background, if they had one, in OP. And this isn't surprising, as this accent was one that travelled. It interacted with other accents in the British Isles, and crossed the Atlantic in the Mayflower. So this might be the point to hear a longer piece of OP, and listeners really then need to ask themselves the question, was there any of that which I didn't understand? Here's Oberon's speech from Dream. It well illustrates the way in which the accent expresses a rural theme, and of course the rhymes now work, which didn't before. I know a bank where the wild thyme blows, where oxlips and the nodding violet grows, quite over a canopied with luscious woodbine, with sweet musk roses and with eglantine. There sleeps Titania some time of the night, lulled in these floors with dances and delight. And there the snake throws her enamelled skin, weighed wide enough to wrap a fairy in. And with the juice of this I'll strike her eyes, and make her full of hateful fantasies. Take thou some of it, and sake through this grove. A sweet Titanian lady is in love with a disdainful youth. Anoint his eyes, but do it when the next thing he espies may be the lady. Thou shalt know the man by the Titanian garments he hath on. Effect it with some care, that he may prove more fond on her than she upon her love. Now, when I say that such a speech is understandable, what I mean, of course, is that it's just as understandable as it would be if it were spoken in a modern accent. I'm not saying that OP makes all Shakespeare immediately understandable. If you don't know what eglantine is, for instance, then that's a problem for you, but it's a totally different issue, nothing to do with OP at all. All I'm saying is that anyone who knows what eglantine is will know what eglantine is. The accent won't stop them. I'm not sure how you get rid of the imagined fear of OP in advance. One has to form a climate, I suppose, and this takes time. Maybe in the advance marketing for a production, one should illustrate the accent in some way. That's so much easier now, with iPhone downloads and such like. There haven't been many attempts at it, though, and that's part of the problem. The Globe hasn't repeated the experience since 2005, mainly because it had a change in artistic direction the following year. The RSC showed interest. Indeed, at one point I went over and talked to the company, but then a couple of minor things got in the way, such as rebuilding their theatre. Maybe they'll take up the idea again one day. I know of a couple of theatrical productions of fragments in OP. Mary Key, who visited the Globe during the Romeo production, did something in connection with the Blackfriars project in Virginia. And Alex Torra put on an evening of OP in 2007 called, as I pronounced it to you, in New York. And this was his account to me by email of how the evening went. We presented 13 scenes from 11 different plays performed by 7 actors. The event happened at a tavern in Times Square called The Playwright. And right outside the window, there was a giant billboard that read, Speechless. It was perfect. We invited folks to come and have some food and drinks, and about 60 people came, and we had some great responses. The most popular responses of the evening were how the sound changes allowed the language to move faster and how incredibly enjoyable that was. How the OP actually clarifies rhetoric and wordplay. How many particularly enjoyed the comedies. We had a very successful scene from Taming of the Shrew when Petruchio and Catherine meet for the first time. The scene had absolutely no physical life. They were sitting at music stands and it was enjoyable as ever. At the end of the evening, I kept being asked what the next step is. It's encouraging to know that others know that this exploration doesn't stop here. Well, that sums up the audience reaction question very well. I got exactly the same reactions at the Globe in 2004 and 2005. And you will too, Paul.
I'm looking forward so much to working on the production with you. There is great excitement as well as trepidation about it here. And I look forward to our publishing a second conversation after A Midsummer Night's Dream closes. Many thanks indeed, David.